This sutta is found in the Kosala Sanyutta, which is the third Sanyutta of the Sanyutta Nikaya. I think it's number 17 or something like that. I can't remember now exactly which number it is, but I'll try to bring it out later on, and I can maybe read it out for you, because it's kind of sweet and kind of nice. So we'll have a look at that. I'll try to remember to check it out later on. Okay, so next one. Is it good to write and sell fiction books with Buddhist themes inside it? Motivation is to help bring the Dhamma to those who love reading certain genre of fiction, who otherwise would not think of picking up Buddhism. I suppose it can be a good thing, yeah, if you do it in a good way. It depends, of course, how you do it. But if you do it and you have real Buddhist ideas in there, ideas that maybe inspire people to become better, and you know, if you are a good writer, maybe you can make it very appealing to kind of be compassionate and kind and all of these kind of things. And if you do that, of course, I think it's a good thing, because you have the right motivation doing things in the right way. So it all depends, I suppose, on why you do it and how you do it. But as you say, if you do it with a good motivation, I think it's probably a good thing to do. So, okay. If you wish to kind of pick up on anything as we go along, please do so. Please, you're allowed to, we can have more, a bit more interaction if you like. Dear Ajahn, one of the Noble Eightfold Path, Samma Samadhi is often translated as right concentration. May I know how you would translate it? Thank you. Okay, so this is Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm says if you translate samadhi as concentration, that is very bad. That's what he says. And he has a point, because concentration in the English language, or maybe any kind of European language, I suppose, it often means a lot of willpower. You concentrate on something. You force your mind onto something. When you go to school and you're supposed to read a book or write an essay, the teacher says, concentrate, you know, or really work really hard. And if you do that, you will find if you do that on your meditation object, then after a while the mind gets tired, because you're using force on the meditation object. So it doesn't work. And I know a lot of people, they make this mistake using too much effort in meditation. And one of the ways of looking at meditation is like the gradual movement away from effort towards the easy awareness of the object. We have just a very, very light touch on the breath or whatever it is, and very easy, and then moving away from more and more towards less and less effort, in a sense. And that is one way of looking at meditation, this reduction in effort. And I always hear people say, some of them have been meditating for 10, 20 years, and then one day they realize, I'm still using too much effort in my meditation. Still can't just sit there and just be aware, right? So it's a gradual movement away from that, learning to have pure awareness with no kind of control, nothing really doing anything here. So I think a nice translation that Ajahn Brahm uses is stillness. Stillness is a very simple word, and it's something that we all understand. Of course, it doesn't mean stillness in any kind of way, a simple way. It means a profound stillness of the mind. That's really what it is referring to. So even though it is a simple word, if we use it in the right way, if we understand that it is profound, I think we are on the right track with using stillness. I know that Ajahn Sujato, he is in the process of translating the Nikayas, and he has tried various words for samadhi, and one of the words that he has been using, which I must admit I don't really like myself, but he has been using the word convergence for samadhi, because it's like the mind converging onto the object. But I think it's a bit too fancy, perhaps, to translate, and it's not kind of immediate enough and simple enough to really understand it. But the idea is that the mind converges into one thing, and samadhi is very much similar kind of idea, that the mind converges into one point, right? It kind of makes sense, but maybe a little bit too highfalutin, perhaps. So as for right, I think right is usually acceptable. Some people say samma is is perfect, but I think maybe right to me works better than perfect stillness. Adrian, it is mentioned that we have to be aware and watch our anger before it arises. Many times it is impossible to catch it in time even aware that it has arisen. What can we do to rectify the action other than feeling guilty? That doesn't really work, does it? damage had been done and it cannot be retracted. Thank you. That is a good point. Sometimes when anger arises, it's actually very hard to turn it back because it's a perception that sort of settles in your mind. You are reminded of somebody's bad qualities, and when that perception arises in the mind in a very strong way, it's difficult to move away from that. Once it is infiltrated the mind, it's very hard to get rid of these emotions sometimes. And that is why it is, as you say here, important to catch it as early as possible. Sometimes catching it before it arises can be hard, but even if you catch it early on, as it is about to get established, that is sometimes enough. One of the most important things to be able to do that, of course, is to be aware of the danger of these things. If you have a very keen sense of awareness of how dangerous it is, then you become more heedful, right? You think, wow, this really is dangerous. I better stay away from this. And then that heedfulness will allow you to catch these things earlier on. Your mindfulness will be more attuned to the fact that this is a territory. I don't want to go down that road, down that way. And you turn away in time before it really becomes established in your mind. This is really what it is about, having that ability to really know that this is dangerous. This always leads to serious problems, leads to more rebirth, leads to problems here and now, leads to endless kind of stuff. And once you know that, it becomes easier. So if you want to rectify the action other than feeling guilty, yeah, please don't feel guilty. It's absolutely useless to feel guilty. It makes things worse, right? So instead, be clear about it. Stand back. Try to see what is going on. Okay, this has arisen. And then try the little methods we were talking about before. Remember seeing the good qualities in people. Remember the good qualities in that particular person. Don't communicate with that person if you're feeling angry with somebody. Go away for a while, do something else, even distract yourself a little bit if you have to. But know that if your anger arises, and then your actions often will be affected by that anger. Even if you're able to restrain yourself and not show it outwardly, it doesn't feel natural. Certainly, it's very hard to be nice in that kind of situation. Do things that are, whereby you are kind of distracting yourself a little bit. Do something else. And then if you distract yourself, and sometimes the anger just disappears doesn't take too long. And then you're back in business again, and you can start being friendly or whatever. But the more you build up the idea or perception, one of the things that you find out when you go on retreat or you do some meditation practice, you learn about yourself and what are the biggest problems in your mind. You will know that there are certain people that tend to be problematic in your life. And because of that, it is good to build up like a barrier, a dike in your mind that stops you from being irritated or angry with those particular people. So you spend some time on those people that are particularly difficult, either to see their good qualities and build that up, or to understanding with compassion. Ideally, probably a bit of both, right? So understand them with compassion, that they are trapped in that personality, they can't do much about it, and also focus on the good qualities. And spend time on that, build that up, that perception, and then you're like building a dike which can withstand the flood of negative information when the negative information comes, and then you don't get angry so easily afterwards. A lot of it is in the preparation, a lot of it is in the kind of defensive mechanism you build up beforehand. Okay, dear Bhante, how to deal with thoughts that keep arising during meditation? Can layperson attain nibbana and maintain it till the end of life? Thank you, sadhu times three. Okay, so deal with thoughts that arise during meditation, the best way to deal with it is not to deal with it. That's the dealing that is not to deal. So basically what it means is to stand back and be aware. This is actually a very powerful technique, and it's specifically mentioned by the Buddha in the Vitakka Santana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 20. He talks about various ways of dealing with thoughts, and bad thoughts in particular. And he says all you have to do sometimes, if you're able to stand back, right, and just watch and be aware, a thought is only there because you want it to be there. So there is intention, there is volition, there is the mind, the will to think is there just behind there. So if you stand back and you are just aware and you're just content with whatever is happening, it means that you are no longer involving yourself in that thinking mind. And as long as you're not involving yourself, it means that the mind tends to reduce, the thinking tends to reduce, and you tend to kind of have less of it. But it takes a lot of mindfulness to be able to do that, right? And a lot of time we haven't got enough mindfulness, and because the mindfulness isn't strong enough, that is why then the thinking tends to come back. We're not actually standing back enough. Yes, please.
Bhante, you mentioned about this will that brings that. Is that the anusayanam, the underlying tendencies that is found in one of the Majjhima Nikaya?
It is not exactly the same thing, because the underlying tendencies are more about underlying tendencies of defilements. The will is not necessarily related to the defilements, it can be related to anything. The will is just something that is pretty much always there, almost in any kind of mind state you have. So it is, in a sense, it is underlying, but it's not exactly the same as those underlying tendencies.
Because in the study of neurology, the psychologists have come across the notion now that there is no free will, that there is this underlying tendency that brings thoughts up, and there is no free will, which is quite opposite to what some of the Christians are talking about. So I was thinking that if that has anything to do with the anusayana.
I don't think it has anything to do with the anusayas, but it's true, there is this underlying tendency which is the will. It almost tends to always be there. It's very hard to let go of. And this is one of the things we try to let go of in meditation practice, is the will. The will always makes disturbances, it always creates things, it always kind of, you know, makes you restless or whatever. That's how you recognize the will. The doing that we do is always based on the will. The more peaceful you are, the less will there is, until the will is completely abandoned in samadhi. You could say that it is an underlying tendency, because it is one of the five khandhas is the will. So it's something which is a part of the mind, but it's not actually specifically mentioned as an underlying tendency in the suttas as such. But you could maybe look at it that way. It certainly wouldn't be wrong here, I think. So this is how you deal with the thoughts in meditation practice. You try just to stand back, allow them to be, because they are created by the will. So if you are content and happy and just present with what is going on, you're actually allowing the willpower, the will to kind of dissipate and disappear. Because the will is continued action. Here you're trying the opposite. Contentment is the exact opposite of will. Will is about doing things. If you're content, you don't want to do anything anymore. You don't even want to think. So that's why contentment is the opposite of using the will. Of course, it depends a little bit on what kind of thoughts you have, right? Sometimes there are thoughts that are kind of more defiled. Sometimes if it is angry thoughts, then of course you want to be a bit more proactive and try to counter that anger by a bit of metta, by thinking in a positive way instead, seeing the good qualities again, all that kind of stuff. Also, thoughts of desire can be very kind of disturbing. Sometimes people fantasize about food while they're meditating and that kind of thing. That can also be very disturbing, right? So you try to move away from those things. One way of doing that is to prioritize your meditation. I often like to think that when I meditate, I'm closer to the real meaning of life than any other time during the day. That is when things become more peaceful. That is when kind of you're moving in the right direction with your mind. And if you remember that now, you're closer to the real meaning of life, and that everything else I do in my life, whatever it is to support my meditation practice. Then why think about the supports when I'm actually close to the meaning of life? It doesn't make any sense. You don't think about about this report, the reason why you think about all the other stuff is because you think it is important, right? You think your meditation is there to support the rest of your life, when in fact it's the other way around. The rest of your life is there to support your meditation. And once you get those priorities right, it is actually far more easy to stay with a meditation object than if you have the priorities the other way around. This is one way of doing that, prioritizing. The other way, of course, that is fundamental in meditation practice is to start to find that joy and happiness in meditation. One of the reasons why you're thinking and one of the reasons why the will is going in that direction is because there isn't enough happiness there yet in the meditation practice. And so you try to find that sense of happiness and joy and contentment. And as you do that, this tends to happen automatically. Why think if you have a more profound happiness? The reason why you think is because there is some happiness there. Okay, the second question. Can a layperson attain nibbana and maintain it till the end of life? Well, if you attain nibbana, no more need to maintain, right? You are there. You are finished. Attaining nibbana means precisely that you have abandoned the hindrances and the defilements. So once you become an arahant, there's no going back again. Once you get nibbana, that's it. You are you have gone to the end of the path already. Yeah. So, but maybe what you mean is kind of a lesser thing. Maybe I'm not sure what exactly you are referring to, but there are, of course, degrees of awakening. You can awaken, become a stream enter, a once returner, all of these kind of things. But as long as you come to one of these really high stages in meditation, you are bound to head in the right direction. There's no turning back anymore at that particular point. But, of course, getting there is quite a challenge, especially in lay life. Yes, sir.
Bhante, so the other day my daughter had a food poisoning. So I was reading the Bojanga Sutta.
Yeah.
I was reading the English okay. English translation.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm also not sure whether the Bojanga Sutta is part of the Buddha's words. But what I read and I understand is that the Buddha became sick and he had a monk, arahant, yeah, read him, I think the seven factors of enlightenment.
Yeah.
And after he heard it, and he became well and happy again.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sort, I think, is it related to the previous question just now, saying that after you've gained enlightenment, there is, that's it, you don't have to maintain it, but why would it be that Buddhas and Arahants still go on meditating and become sick and then be reminded that, hey, this is seven factors of enlightenment?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've often wondered about that myself because those suttas are a little bit strange. You have all these arahants and they get the recitation of the bojangas and then they are okay again afterwards. It's a little bit strange. I don't really fully understand why it is the case myself, but generally speaking, even if you are the Buddha, even if you're an arahant, you still enjoy practicing meditation because it's just peaceful, right? If you are there with the body, as the Buddha was saying, I was reading out early on this retreat about the Buddha towards the end of his life and his body is falling apart and he's having pain in his body and all of these things happening. And he says, the only time I have no pain in the body is free from these things, is when I attain a deep state of samadhi. Even for the Buddha has a physical body. Even the Buddha has the problem of all this hearing and seeing things, coming into the mind. And when you go into samadhi, all you have left is bliss. So it makes sense that even for a Buddha and for an arahant, you still want to go into those states because you get away from some of the problems. But exactly why the bojangas are recited and then the Buddha kind of comes out of that, I must admit, I'm not entirely sure, but I guess it has something to do with remembering the Dhamma and the power of the Dhamma, that ability to remember and empower the Dhamma inside of you probably helps you to somehow overcome that illness in a certain way. But why he needs somebody to recite it, why he can't think of it himself, not I'm not entirely sure why that is the case. It's one of those slightly mysterious things that you sometimes read in the suttas. Okay, so let us move on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, in a sutta, the Gatikara, the potter, couldn't become a monk because he had to take good care of his old blind parents. Is it always the case that lay people who are anagamis cannot become a monk or nun because they need to take care of their parents? What about Nanda Mata and Chitta the householder? Did they not become renunciants for the same reason? Thank you. I think there probably are many reasons why anagamis do not become monastics. There must be some sense that they have some responsibilities somewhere in lay life, not just parents, but any kind of other responsibility as well might be reasons why they do not become monastics. It doesn't say anywhere in the suttas exactly why, but I guess blind parents is obviously a very powerful one, because otherwise the parents might just die. And I guess when you have that kind of level of virtue, you'll be very keen on looking after your parents properly, probably. Nanda Mata, Chitta the householder, Ugga the householder, and many of these other anagamis that are mentioned in the suttas, it is not mentioned specifically why they stay in lay life. But presumably, maybe they have children, maybe they have some kind of responsibility that they have to look after. And that is all I can really say, because it isn't specifically mentioned. Okay. Dear Ajahn, do the devas and nagas of mighty power only associate and sometimes help the pure ones? Do they respond and help us on worldly matters as well as spiritual path, as in resolving obstacles and aiding opportunity when we pray as under the Bodhi tree and share merits with them? Are they all very immersed in their many pleasures, physical and mental? Devas and Nagas, do they as only associate and sometimes help the pure ones? I don't think it is so much that. I don't think they necessarily associate all that much with anybody in particular. It's just that if you have that vision, that ability to see things, people or beings in other realms, often you also have the ability to communicate with these beings, right? So somebody who has very good psychic powers might communicate with the devas and say, "How are you? How are you guys?" Is it bad to call the devas guys? I don't know. Maybe that's not such a good thing. So you can communicate with them, and you can talk to them, and you can see what they're up to and how they're living and all of these kind of things. And in fact, the Buddha, before his final awakening, is supposed to have done that, to really understand the nature of samsara properly, right? So he kind of hung out with the devas for a while and talked to them and chatted with them and to see what their life was like. So it's more that if you have a certain degree of purity, then you will tend to see these things. Not so much, I think, that the devas and nagas necessarily associate with you. Maybe if it's very pure devas and pure nagas, and they have some idea of the spiritual path, not always will they have that idea, but if they do, then maybe they will come to some kind of monk or somebody to ask for some advice. That is always possible. But I think this will be very extremely rare, and very rare circumstances these things happen. Do they respond and help us in worldly matters as well as the spiritual path? Well, have you seen any Nagas helping you out in the worldly matters? I've never really heard any. Sorry. as in resolving obstacles and aiding the opportunity, it is said sometimes, like in the what is called the Metta Anisangsa Sutta, was found in the Anguttara Nikaya 10s and 11s, gives the qualities of the benefits of metta practice. And one of those benefits of metta practice is that the devas sometimes look after you. So if you have a very pure heart, then it is possible, it seems, to actually be helped by these beings. Because I suppose they are attracted to you. They can probably see your mind directly and see whether you have a very pure mind. And if you have a very pure mind, then they might come and help you if you are in trouble or something like that. But remember, this is not something that you should rely on. Right? This is what I was saying the other day found in the Ratapala Sutta, that there is no protector, there is no overlord in this world. You are basically responsible for yourself. You have to look after yourself. Don't kind of ask for protection from outside in this way, because it is unreliable, it is uncertain. The devas probably get distracted, right? They have to go for dinner or something like that, right? Oh, I forgot about you, oops. And then you are in trouble because the devas got distracted. So basically don't rely on these things. Remember, these are not enlightened beings. They are, you know, they have their own lives and all of these things. So don't kind of worry too much about that. Praying under the Bodhi tree and sharing merit with them, I wouldn't really recommend praying under the Bodhi tree, because praying, asking for favors on the outside is not really the Buddhist way of doing things. The Buddhist way of doing things is to take full responsibility for yourself. It is kind of scary, right, to take full responsibility for yourself. I am responsible. I have to look after myself. But actually, if you think about it in the right way, it's also very empowering, because it means that you have the ability to live your life to the fullest by living in the right way. You have the ability to change your own life, to make yourself more happy. If you rely on external powers, it is very uncertain, and you're not really using yourself to the maximum to apply yourself to your own happiness and the spiritual path. So don't forget about these external powers. There's too much of this kind of thinking going on in every religion in the world, including Buddhism, and I would not recommend this as the right way of doing things. It detracts from the path, detracts from taking full responsibility for yourself. When you start taking full responsibility for yourself, that is when you start making real progress, rather than asking the devas and the nagas to do this for you. Okay, thank you very much for all the hard work and dedication for our benefit. We wish you good health, good rest and energy. Please let us know if we have missed out in anything, e.g. your diet, in our care. That is very kind of you, and it's very, very sweet, and much appreciated that you are so caring. And if we care for each other in this way, then we're all going to go a long way on the Buddhist path. Bhante, sometimes it is very difficult to reduce resentment against a family member who ill-treated me through harsh words and scolding and putting me in my place as a junior sibling. How do I develop metta for the older person? What you have to remember is that the reason why the older person is the way they are is, again, not because they choose to be there. You happen to be their sibling, and because of that, you were in the wrong place at the wrong time, right? Unfortunately, you were reborn in that family, perhaps because you probably had some attachment to them in the past life. You got attached to the wrong person. That was part of the problem. Yeah. So don't worry about that. What you have to learn to do is you have to learn to remember that they are the way they are. Got nothing to do with you. It has to do with them. It has to do with their background, their conditioning, their past lives perhaps. Who knows where these things come from? And they didn't have any choice. They had to behave like that. If you hadn't been the sibling, somebody else had been the sibling instead, they would have to go through the same things, right? It has everything to do with them. In a sense, you have very good grounds for feeling a bit sorry for the sibling, because they probably don't want to hurt you, and yet somehow something inside of them is compelling them, making them hurt you in a way, even though they don't really want to do that. So I know this is very hard, because people in families are so close to us, and often it is very difficult for that reason to let go of these things because they are so close. More questions? Okay, keep them coming. Okay. I shouldn't know which one is yours, is that right? Otherwise it gets embarrassing. I put it underneath, so pretend that, yeah, okay. So we don't know which one it is. Okay, now we never know. That's good. So And remember that, even though somebody is your family members, they are just like other people, sometimes good, sometimes bad. And you just have to learn to see them as a person rather than see them as a family member. And when you see them as a person who has the same problems as everybody else, you have a more neutral look at them. Then, normally, you should be able to have more compassion for them. Right? Imagine, it's a kind of a tragedy. If you want to be kind, you want to be nice, but your conditioning actually hinders you. Right? You are stopped from your conditioning, from actually being as nice as you want to be. It is true for all of us. We all like to be nice all the time, but sometimes things kind of comes out of our actions or out of our mouth. We don't really want to come out. Even though we're trying our very best, we can't stop ourselves. And then there are other people for whom this happens even much more than for us, and they can't stop them because the conditioning is so powerful. And I think we all know in our heart somewhere that kindness always leads to happiness for ourselves and for others. But even though we know that, very often it is so hard to do these things. So once you start seeing it like that, then you can have more compassion, more understanding. And remember non-self. There's nobody in there really controlling these things. It's all conditioning, right? You are like the ship on the ocean. The ship that has no rudder, it has no engine, and the ship on the ocean that has no rudder and no engine and no steering mechanism. What happens to that ship? It goes according to the currents and according to the wind. Wherever the wind pushes it, the ship goes. Wherever the current takes it, that's where the ship goes. We are like ships on the ocean. There's no real steering mechanism. We go according to the currents and the wind. This is what conditioning means, right? Okay, so hopefully you are able to work a bit with that, see what happens. Okay, thank you so very much, Ajahn, for the extracts you so kindly and with great care and effort presented for our benefits. They help us to focus more easily on the main points of the suttas rather than getting lost in the repetitive words. Thank you also for the many elaborations, some coming from your own deep practice. They really help to make the teachings clearer and very uplifting. Sadhu times three. In order to have a wider and easier to capture and remember the bird's eye view, may we suggest to have a diagram or mind map or of clusters of principles of suttas interconnected in print form, I think you have here. We may do this in future by forming interactive groups led by Ajahn summary and outlines in mind maps. This is my humble desire, if it is not too much. Okay, well, you could try to make one of these mind maps, right? I know that some of these mind maps already exist online. I know that some of the people on Sutta Central, Sutta Central is where all the suttas are kept, there is a discourse platform there, a discussion platform, and some of these mind maps have already been created there on Sutta Central, I think. Yeah. So, Wei Yin, you are the master, you are one of the Sutta Central people. You have been there sometimes. What? Very quiet. Very quiet. Okay, yeah. That's very good. So, you can... maybe you can talk to Wei Yin. Maybe she will help you out with are you interested in these kind of things, Wei Yin? Do you like this kind of... You're not interested in this kind of things. Okay, I apologize. Are you all right? Okay. Because Wei Yin is very knowledgeable about the suttas as well. She sometimes tells me which suttas it is when I kind of forget about these things. That's very, very nice. So, sometimes if you try these things yourself, creating a mind map, you learn a lot about the suttas in the process. If you get other people to do it for you, you can still learn a bit, but by drawing it yourself, you learn enormous amounts. By just trying to put it together, it may take you a long time to get to the final point, but in the process, wow, you learn so much about these things. And this is, I think, the way to learn the most is by applying yourself in this way. And that's why it's also nice to have a bit more interaction here as well between us, I think. Yeah. Okay, so good luck. I hope you can get something done with that. Okay, dear Ajahn, in Majjhima Nikaya 19, two kinds of thoughts. What is the meaning of non-cruelty? non-ill will? Is it the metta Brahma Vihara? Okay, so non-ill will is literally non-ill will. It's the lack of ill will. And one... Very helpful, right? So what... The reason why it is expressed in this way, it may sound a bit strange, but of course, metta is one of those non-ill will. Metta is the exact opposite of ill will. When we have ill will, it is because we are focusing on the negative qualities in other people. If you focus on the good qualities, that's when you have metta. So goodwill is a good translation for metta, actually, because metta is derived from the word mitta, and mitta means friend. That's where it actually is derived from. So it means like goodwill and friendliness. So one way, the main way perhaps, of having non-ill will is precisely to have metta. But the reason why a word like non-ill will is used is because it is broader than that. Because sometimes you can have very high states of mind, like upekkha, for example, or even compassion, but certainly upekkha, which is like beyond goodwill, beyond metta, but it is still non-ill will. And this is why I think they use a broader word rather than specifically use metta in that kind of context. Yeah, so that is what I think is going on there. And non-cruelty, again, what that means is really having not being harsh, not being ruthless. It means caring. So the opposite or the main aspect of non-cruelty is compassion. That's the opposite of not caring about other people. Not caring is kind of the negative thing here, and compassion is like caring about others. And again, the reason why compassion isn't used as the word is because non-cruelty also is broader than compassion. It also includes things like upekkha, as I was saying before. So this is why these kind of slightly strange terms are used. Okay, number two, as I abided thus diligent, ardent, resolute, does it mean during meditation or during moment to moment while doing daily chores? Thank you so much. So, you can, if you listen to, I don't know, maybe you were not here during the first days, but all of this, I actually did explain all of this during the first few days. So if you listen to the recordings, you should be able to get, hopefully, a little bit of in-depth explanation of these things. But the explanation, this particular phrase, it comes after the point where the Buddha-to-be says, I divided my thinking into two categories, the good thoughts and the bad thoughts. And then he says, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. So what it means there is the using of wisdom to understand what is bad and what is good in the mind, right? So diligent here, which is really the word is appamada, really means heedful. It means being careful. It means being circumspect. It means reflecting properly and contemplating properly before you do anything. That's really what it means. And ardent is atapi, which means like having energy. Resolute is pahitata, which comes from padana, which means like effort, having effort again, right? All of these things, being heedful, having effort, being energetic, actually refers back to being wise. Because the idea of dividing your thinking into bad and good thoughts is all about wisdom, right? It's not about really effort as such. It's about thinking in the right way. A lot of the right effort on the Buddhist path is about reflecting in the right way, understanding what is good, what is bad, and how to use our mind in the right way. That is what a lot of it is about. And so it's very interesting that wisdom power is really far more important on the Buddhist path than willpower. Wisdom power is what really matters the most. So do you abide diligent, ardent, and resolute? Well, you should always have a sense of appamada, of being heedful. Heedfulness is always important, right? The idea that you're always careful, always circumspect, you always try to ask yourself, is it the right thing to say in this situation? Maybe I'm thinking the wrong thought, right? Always being careful in how you deal with other people, treat other people. And if you have that care moment to moment, even in daily life, then you are going to go very fast on this path. Remembering what really matters in life, what is really important. And what is important, of course, is always kindness, right? In every moment, the way we think, the way we speak, the way we act. And if you remember that one thing in your daily life all the time, then you will have a lot of success in moving forward on the Buddhist path. It's quite simple, right? So that's your mind map for you. One word, kindness. Yeah. Okay. So there you are, done. Okay. So, before the enlightenment, the Bodhisattva attained the jhanas of neither perception nor non-perception, but still not satisfied. Is this the same arupa jhana as when he had gone through it all the way to cessation of perception and feeling? Nirodha samapatti. Thank you, Bhante. Okay, so... the neither perception, non-perception is sometimes called the eighth jhana, but cessation of perception of feeling is sometimes called the ninth. It's not really jhana anymore. It's ninth attainment, right? So these are incredibly high attainments on the path of meditation. Really, really way up there. Cessation of perception and feeling is slightly different, because at that point everything is gone. Everything disappears. You blank out, and you stay blanked out for many, many hours, and then you come back afterwards and you say, "Wow, that was amazing," and you feel incredible purity and incredible power of the faculties after that, because you've been absolutely still, absolutely blanked out for so long. Neither perception, non-perception is coming close, but you're not quite there yet. You're kind of moving into that area. These are not quite the same thing, but very closely related to each other here. Exactly what the Bodhisattva attained is not entirely clear. It does seem from the Pali text that he attained neither perception, non-perception, but there is some discussion about that, whether that really was the case or not. And there is some indication perhaps in the Agama, the parallel in Chinese translation, to that sutta, that he may not have gone all the way that far. But it is one of those controversial topics, and I probably no need to go into too much detail about that, unless you really are incredibly interested in that. So I'll leave it at that for now, and get back to me if you really want to ask more about that. Okay, I would like to refer to Anguttara Nikaya 5.162, yes, which is the removing of resentment sutta, right? Would thinking arousing sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, wishing him to abandon bad behavior for concern that he may end up in hell, then arouse strong sense of ego and conceit in oneself over that person? Okay. So you are afraid that you might get conceited if you have too much compassion. You think, "Oh, these bad people around there, I will just have compassion for them, but they are really bad, right? I am much better. I am much better than that." So that is going about it the wrong way. That is not the right way to do it. And the way to get around that is to remember that you also have been there before. You have also done exactly the same things. And unless you get your act together and really practice well, you will go there again in the future. Right? So this is your chance never to have to walk in the desert between villages and not having any doctors and being sick. This is your chance, your opportunity to get out of that predicament now, before it is too late. Remember, as long as you are not a stream enterer, as long as you haven't reached a full awakening yet, it means that you will one day end up in precisely this predicament. It's because of non-self. It's because conditionality is such that it will condition you into that situation sooner or later. Because of that, you don't really have much grounds for conceit, right? If you are just like they are, and they are just like you, it kind of takes away the basis for conceit. Yes, right now, maybe you are kind of wise than they are, next year is the other way around. So how can you be conceited anymore? It's impossible. And this is the idea on the Buddhist path about not having the superiority conceit, the equality conceit, or the inferiority conceit. Because all of these things are based on the delusion of the self. The only way you can compare one person to another one is because you have some sense that there is something inside of you that can be compared. But if we are always changing, always moving around, always becoming something else, what are you going to compare? Are you going to compare the you of today with that person today? Are you going to compare the, sometime during the day you might get really angry. Are you going to take that person to compare with the other person? Or are you going to take the kind-hearted person later in the day, which is really kind? Which person are you going to compare with? Always changing, right? There is no stability there. There is no real, permanent essence that you can compare between people. And once you get this kind of this idea, you understand after a while that to be conceited is crazy. It doesn't make any sense at all. Instead, you have compassion for that person at the same time understanding one day you might be in that situation. And in a sense, you are having compassion also for yourself when you have compassion for that other person, because we can all be end up in that state sooner or later. If you are conceited, then you are also building up a problem in the fact that you will feel really inferior eventually if you get in that position yourself, right? Because then you think other people will look down on you and think that you are really kind of nothing, and they will kind of treat you badly because of that. So please don't fall into that trap of feeling conceited in this way. Then you are indeed undermining things. Okay, so we have come to the last question for tonight. Bhante, there are a few dimensions or concepts of the self. This body is mine, first fetter, sakkaya ditti. Selfishness or self-centeredness, an identity as we know ourselves. Ego, mana, eighth fetter. From the Buddhist point of view, what is the Pali word for two and three? Okay, well, first of all, I'm going to have to correct you because you haven't got the other ones right quite right either, right? So first of all, I will correct you a little bit. Sakkaya ditti does not mean the body is mine. This is quite the common misconception, because sakkaya, you think that kaya is the body, but actually sakkaya ditti means any kind of view that there is a self in the five aggregates. Sakkaya ditti can refer to any aspect of the mind, any aspect of the body. It is not just an idea of the body. This is a common misconception in Thailand, some of the Thai ajahns, and the reason why they say this is because they assume the word body is in the word, so it must refer to the body. But actually, in the suttas, the word of the Buddha, it does not mean that. And that is a very important difference. Sakkaya ditti means any view of self anywhere in the five khandhas. So that is the first thing here. Selfishness or self-centeredness. What would that be in Pali? Self-centeredness. So that is more like a greed, probably, right? Very similar to greed, very similar to sensual desires, basically, when we start to think about ourselves more, very closely related to that. Is there a specific word for this in Pali language, self-centeredness? Probably is, but I must admit I'm getting a little bit tired now. My mind is not entirely, very far from being entirely clear, actually. Let me think about that. Maybe I'll come out tomorrow and I'll have a word for you for that one. An identity as we know ourselves. Identity as we know ourselves. That's probably very similar to sakkaya ditti in many ways. The identity that we have, the view that we have ourselves, the view as how we relate to the five khandhas, right? What is the real me? Consciousness, the will, these kind of things. I would say it's probably quite related to Sakkaya Ditti, the view. But a lot of this is just the perception, right? The feeling that there is an I inside of us. Sometimes it may not be related to a view at all. It's just this feeling that I exist. We all have that feeling, except if you're an Arya or an Arahant. People have this feeling. And that feeling is kind of the perception of self. And it's sometimes called ahankara, mamakara, I-making and mind-making in the suttas. And it's just this kind of continuous fabrication of me taking new forms depending on where your attachments are and what kind of views you have about these things. Mana, the eighth fetter, is usually translated as conceit or pride. So it is, of course, very closely related to ego, but ego can mean different things in English. It has a lot to do with the sense of I again, who you take yourself to be, your sense of identity, right? And then when somebody kind of threatens your sense of identity, the ego comes out and says, no, you know, don't threaten me. And then you kind of get upset because of that. Okay, so that is all for tonight. So let us pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha before we call it a night.